Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Effects, and it's an absolute pleasure to have you back here. I'm not sure what it says about the regular listeners to the show. I think it's a compliment, but think about it. You're in a comfortable spot. You're listening to a commentary about that usually has a thread that connects us with things Masonic. We sit back and without being self-conscious about it, we listen to poetry and we listen to an analysis. It's as if we are learners, but we're also fans. We're people that and perhaps appreciate that they're it is always a different way of approaching life and the world around us, and we're curious enough, I think, that perhaps we'll find something, we'll discover something, hopefully within ourselves, but something affirming about the universe that we're in. Can you imagine? I just finished a short article, and it spills over. Of course, so many things spill over. But before I do that, I want to acknowledge you as a listeners group again. And perhaps it's just that the amazement of the bread listener. If you do, will indulge me, I want to share my gratitude to our listeners in Serbia and from Greece, the Philippines. I just have this sense of such enthusiastic brethren from the Philippines. Ah, the keenness of our South African listeners. And then on bigger, different kind of a scale, I think it's fair to say, listeners from the United States, how many Grand Lodges are there? 50? I'm not really sure of that, and I apologize for that. Of course, within Canada, my nation, and the United Kingdom. It's a pleasure, of course, and I think you're, as a group, are both a barometer and a source of accountability for me. This program needs to be legitimate in some way. It needs to have relevance, or this kind of an audience would not be tuning in, is my opinion. I'm led to think that I was aware that we're in this age of being reminded of this age of communication, and partly it's because of the very the world news that's been capturing a lot of attention, particularly in the Middle East, as well as news locally about the effects of earlier colonialism here in Canada, and the rather unpleasant truth that is coming to us about these little Native children as recently as the 50s. And I'm thinking, my goodness, that's recent, where little First Nations children were being sold for $10. It just staggers my conscience seems to come to a stop. I'm trying to register I don't know how to process this except with this profound and overwhelming sense of shame and then this sense of duty to try and correct what was done. That's not the only spark happening on the horizon, right? As we know. But it does give us a moment here to pause and to reflect. Remember, the communication that we have today is profound compared to even when we were children. In some ways, would it be better for us to be born today so that all of this information is nothing new? It doesn't stand out as a contrast to what was. It would be taken for granted. Well, in some ways, I think yes. But it's all relative to each generation, isn't it? We were being taught and exposed to ideas that were inconsistent with the experiences of our elders at the time when we were children. That phase, that window, has always happened with each new generation. We grow up and we become familiar with certain things, and then so we notice the change. But to expect the little people around us that haven't experienced the change, like arguing with or trying to berate, I'm sorry, I apologize if this sounds a bit heavy-handed, but I see older people berating children for being unable to write in cursive writing because they haven't been taught. Because when we look at it, quite frankly, the children need keyboard skills. Well, that makes sense. In the 60s, when I was getting into that, it was looked at as something effeminate, that typists, you know, women's work. And yet I was drawn to it because I had some strange notions in the day. One of the more valuable things that I ever did, as you can imagine, be a touch typist all my life. But that perspective changes, and it reminds me of some ideas that I've been, you know, wrestling with about the world and the life that I live, being an illusion. And I apologize here. I'm affected by things that I don't truly fully understand, particularly quantum physics and the dating of the changing age of the universe that's happening. Do I feel that it should only be 3.5 billion years old like it was for a long time? Oh, no, of course not. I want to know more accurately, and as the tools are refined and applied, we are taking in new information. We are rethinking for previous assumptions. Good. It's always been the case for humanity. But to say that the adjustment has been simple, I don't think that's exactly fair. It takes time. But what makes it easier is being of a particular mindset where the change is not necessarily different, but an ongoing phenomena, an ongoing sight that we experience over a fairly short life span compared to the mountains and the trees. I'm here in a blink of an eye. The point I'm making is about the illusions that we live with. And I have some comfort in that, brethren. It's comforting when not that somebody is, not that the people trying to sell a product that, or the psychologists creating a software that is going to draw my attention away from what my normal domesticity requires, as if somebody else is thinking, telling me that they know better than me where my attention should be drawn because they're selling a product. I know you could say that's mercantilism, Graham, that, you know, the emphasis on by government on anything that promotes business, and then that it seems to have that vague trickle down that, you know, that self-serving kind of a notion that everything is going to trickle down and the whole, if big business prospers, and then it'll trickle down and the communities that we create will be prosperous as well. It's not exactly proving to be an accurate notion anymore, but it's the illusion. If we can gain people's attention, it messes with our sense of reality and truth, doesn't it? Truth and justice, and then, you know, I can, like you, I hear the, you know, everybody around me has opinions, and I've likened that to living in a world of experts, and I do truly feel that, just as I would with any of you. You are more expert about you and your life than anybody. Other people may know things about the human condition that applies to you, but there is only one of us that's been with you every second, and that's you. Oh yes, don't be too overwhelmed with the corrective element that what if the boy doesn't pay any attention? Well, if the boy doesn't pay any attention, there's reasons for it. And that's fair enough. Who am I to say what a person should attend to and for how long? And who am I, really? Life is an illusion. What if there is more to it than not completely other dimension? What if the physicists are speaking to us as, and have crossed that line into philosophy? And we know that there are questions that physicists probe where the mathematics doesn't generate findings, and the shift of thinking toward philosophical injunctions. Well, what if, and there is a possibility that the illusion that we call, that what we're calling reality is in fact an illusion, an impression. Well, you would deserve, and rightfully so, to understand evidence I bring to prove that. And then the epistemologists amongst you will say, well, how do you know that? How do you find that? How did you find that proof? Rightfully so. So ontologists on one hand and epidemiologists on the other, you're telling us things. For when I was a boy, this would have been mocked. We were at a point where we were still mocking children that were wearing glasses. Can you imagine? That wasn't that long ago. And the rights of women were still draconian. It's no great. It's still not. We talk about equality glibly, but things were different, but, you know, we have progressed. Maybe that's just me wanting to believe that we've progressed. The illusions could be a source of perspective that brings new meaning to us. And if that's the case, Isn't it an imperative for some of us to explore that? Doesn't it draw on our curiosity to just take a look, just in case the physicists talking about multi-dimensional space have something that are bringing up something that that benefits us and in future will be mainstream. Just like, you know, when you think about the arts, the arts often is where new history, the unpleasantness of history and innovation would occur. And it's usually like new ideas are usually repelled because they're different, not because they're more accurate or less, but simply because in our minds, difference is not great. It's not good. But it starts off as a small, small edge of the wedge, the idea. And if the idea has merit, it grows. And you can look at your own experience, and I'm sure you can find those examples where there have been ideas that when we were taught completely wrong. Don't carry that thought. That is somehow a contradiction. It's dissonant. It's anti-something. Only to find that that it's no longer a scandal, that we're beginning to dissect ideas and human condition, and we're understanding it with some degree of, oh my goodness, empathy. Isn't that just the way with masonry? I talking to a lovely group of Masons, very much in earnest, looking at meritocracy within the lodge. Merit, it is lumpy, and it's not as easy as just bully politics and power and authority. It's not as easy because those are sort of commonplace or, you know, mundane. However, this is a group that's striving for an enriched experience, and they're willing to look at the different facets of merit and struggle to commit to a struggle to find consensus, to first to understand it and to learn how to speak with each other. Rhetoric is helping us to do that. But to not lose our place, that rhetoric isn't about adapting to somebody else's truth. We all have our own opinion, but it's, as masonry tends to emphasize, it's an expansion of our capacity to empathize. The light. I won't belabor the point, but I think you understand. Now, if that's the case, if we are influenced by illusion, which I think we are, you know, optics matter. Isn't it possible that within our Masonic Brotherhood, within the Masonic framework, I'm trying to move away from this notion of gender-specific thinking, because I think it's not necessarily, it's part of masonry and part of the world, but not exactly sure it's truth anymore. And I'm examining that. So consider me a Masonic agnostic about that part. And I'm leaning toward, you know, the deregulation of masonry in terms of the purity of the thinking. The ideas, isn't it possible that the ideas about there are values, being a part of a values-based way of life, a mindset, is able to project calmness and reason and focus and inspiration. Well, why would I only think that the despot can influence by suggesting that only he has the answer. Or the fascists have influence because they say, well, government has power and the answer to all rests with government, not with you. I'm not quite ready to think that only the negative values have influence. But that being the case, Masonry doesn't have the same muscularity because it's a different way of thinking about power.
Mm.
Oh, more, and I know this breaks a lot of the rules. We discuss, we weigh in with this sense of need to know and need to address uncommon topics, even at the risk of discomfort, and not to be distracted with comfort zones or whatever. The mind works that way. The mind likes efficiency, and efficiency is patterns. And it does things for us that we are not always aware. It's like you think about eyewitnesses to a crime. And we find this now, if we have the surveillance equipment showing us the pictures, we are being reminded that what we think we see is just that. What we think, it doesn't necessarily fit with what is. Yeah. who would care about it? Well, I think who would care about it is people that are curious. What can we do? You and I project a different image of the world, and we become something symbolic to other people. Now, that may be troubling if we think, well, my goodness, it's, you know, that must be entitlement or arrogance we're talking about. Not at all. It's just the way that history is wrapped around us. And there is a curiosity. And if you've not, the last time I felt it was when I was with another brother, and a young woman was curious and asking, and there, instead of, you know, teetering and being troubled, I began explaining what is it? And it seemed like as natural as falling off a log. But before I fall off this log too fast, I'm going to offer you a commentary that maybe it reveals too much about me. It's an order in motion. It's troubling that I've been realizing everything is in motion all the time and nothing is in a state of permanence except this dynamic environment that we're in, even to a molecular level, neutrons penetrating all that there is. And yet I do like the illusion. I like the stability. I like seeing the dust particles in the light. You know, and what's beautiful is that within the mind, I don't have to settle on one version. Oh my goodness, isn't this the stuff of a conversation? So I think it's your round. And I do like an ale or a glass of port, please, if we're going to just a sip. And to maybe over a chessboard, and we can talk about such things when it comes up. This isn't like, oh, this is the agenda we're going to talk about. No, when it pops up. And of course, the history, I think you're going to be quite pleased with the history portion and then what it starts to reveal about history. And maybe how that reflects on us today. How can I have a difficulty with a program that includes the poetry of John Keats? Yeah, and we'll talk about the impact of his illness. You know, he's quite young when he developed the tuberculosis, and there's a strong likelihood that it's influenced his writings. But apart from all of that, there's something. This is a time for a deep breath, hey? Deep breath. It's a little bit. Thanks for tuning in. Sit back and relax. Here. Thank you. Stanley Turrentine, for those that collect that type of thing. An order in motion. If you come into Freemasonry, you are likely, if you are fortunate enough, to fall under the influence of ritual, the sounds, the images, the coordination, the our way, our manner when we are with each other shows the importance, mutual importance. It is through ritual, I believe, that we come together. That is where we exchange energy when we gather. And where we confess our fidelity to truth as a lifestyle. Fortunately, the privacy of masonry has been extended to a man at a keyboard in his private quarters late into the night. We can learn for ourselves what is considered an anathema and speculate on what is revealed. Being reminded there is a part of us that is connected to the best parts of humanity is a big, big step. Symbolism makes it possible to explore our conscience, guilt, remorse, joy, and happiness. And the perfection of knowing ugly is also part of nature. What we see and think is in the mind. How we navigate is in our character. To find the roadmap to happiness leads us through virtues. And that seems too simple. I have an aversion to happiness that comes with a price, especially the demands of virtue on an incomplete man. But then anything worthwhile comes at a price. The doubting Thomas, the skeptic, lives amongst us, perhaps inside us. So is consensus even possible when he declares his truth? Static. We're not static, we're in motion. The answer is a qualified yes. Consensus is possible. Some call this progress. Some call it change. Some call it nothing at all. And yet our attitude is shaped by Freemasonry more than many of us might care to admit. Thank you. fans of Horace Silver will recognize that. Interesting tune, Lonely Women. I'm going to share with you, it's the Poetry Corner. I'm going to share with you some portions from a letter written by Reverend Dr. Gideon Cecil. Not trying to promote the particular faith, but this is in the Kater News, if you've ever visited that. It's an interesting site. But my point, poetry, he explains, has always been a part of human life. It is an art that lies in the soul and spirit of man since the beginning of time. A poet writes always of his personal life and experience. He writes because he has an indispensable desire in his heart to express his ideas, to objectify his poetic philosophy about life. The English poet Shelley said that a poem is the very image of life expressed in its eternal truth. The profound truth in this line written by Shelley can be seen in the poetry of all the classical poets, from Homer to Shakespeare. The writing of great poetry has always been the primary vehicle for expressing one's thoughts, observations, historical events, and various philosophies from a different perspective about life. A great poem, unlike a novel or a short story, can be digested and absorbed in our souls and can become a part of us forever. We should talk about that, Doctor. The poetry of Homer, Virgil, Dante, Tagore, and Shakespeare has become part of the literary world until today. The divinity of their poetry has become sermons and prayers over the ages. I suppose. Poets speak a language all their own. Poets think in images, words, naming a sensory thing or action. A great poetry requires a reader to experience a series of sensory experiences. Having experienced the image, we need to interpret it. The vital message and metaphor are what the poet wants you to know. Poetry gives pleasure first, then truth, hidden in complex imagery and philosophy. Its language is charged, intensified, and sophisticated. Intuition, which we sometimes call inspiration, will push us to write lines we ourselves are unable to write by our natural intellectual apprehension. Until today, many literary scholars believe that Shakespeare never wrote what he had written because he was not educated at a university. Shakespeare was naturally gifted and inspired to write what he had written. The poet T.S. Eliot believed that Shakespeare never did any real thinking to write, but wrote upon inspired thoughts given to him by the imperial muse of poetry. Man, I like T.S. Poetry is an art, the greatest of the fine arts and the hardest in which to reach true perfection. The true poet must be genuine, who has faith and confidence that his work will do something to the world and the society he lives in. Just a prelude. In the summer of 1818, John Keats went on a walking tour of the Lake District, Northern England and Scotland, with his friend Charles Brown. And his exposure and overexertions on that trip brought on the first symptoms of tuberculosis, of which he would later die. On his return to London, a brutal criticism of his early poems appeared in Blackwood's magazine, followed by a similar attack on Endymion in the Quarterly Review. Endymion is one of his more famous poems. Contrary to later assertions, Keats met these reviews with a calm assertion of his own talents, and he went on steadily writing poetry. But there were family troubles. Keats' brother, Tom, had been suffering from tuberculosis for some time, and in the autumn of 1818, the poet nursed him through his last illness. At about the same time, he met Fanny Brawn, a near neighbor in Hampstead, and he fell haplessly and tragically in love. The relation with Fanny had a decisive effect on Kate's development. She seems to have been an exceptional young woman of firm and generous character and kindly disposed toward Keats. But he expected more, perhaps more than anyone could give, as is evident from his overwrought letters. Both his uncertain material situation and his failing health, in any case, made it impossible for their relationship to run a normal course. After Tom's death, Keats moved to Wentworth Place with Brown, his friend. In April of 1819, Brown and her mother became their next-door neighbors. In about 1819, in October, Keats engaged her, Fanny. So this poem that we're looking at is written during that period. He had been diagnosed, he's showing symptoms of tuberculosis, and without the modern remedies, you can imagine mortality was clear, especially if you just watched your brother, nursed your brother until his death of tuberculosis. This is Ode on Indolence. Indolence is usually considered a crime, a sin, isn't it? So here we have a fellow that is looking at it from a much different state of mind. The principal theme in Ode on Indolence holds that the pleasant numbness of the speaker's indolence is a preferable state to the more excitable states of love and ambition and poetry. One of the great themes of Keats' odes is that of the anguish of mortality, the pain and frustration caused by the changes and endings inevitable in human life, which are contrasted through the poems with the permanence of art. I like to think that perhaps, you know, he wrote this in somewhere between March and June of 1819, and I like to think that this is a way of letting us share how we, in a sense, convince ourselves we become immortal. It's indolence is generally considered a defect. But in his letter to George, his brother, Keats writes, in this state of effeminacy, the fibers of the brain are relaxed in common with the rest of the body. And to such a happy degree that pleasure has no show of enticement and pain, no unbearable frown. This is the only happiness and is a rare instance of advantage in the body overpowering the mind. The poem wasn't published until 1848, more than a quarter century after Keats died. I want you to sit back. It does draw on some interesting forms. He created an adjective, Phidian, and that picks up on Phidias, the name of the Greek sculptor who supposedly sculptured or at least supervised the sculpting of the friezes around the Parthenon, which we know as the Elgin Marbles. And he had seen them in 1816, where we won't get into the dynamics of that, will we? I won't share with you the words because all the different words are the highlights, but I'll give you just a general sense. This is really the romantic period, you know, the celebration of awe-inspiring powers of nature, really. That's what he's looking at. And in the Ode on Indolence was probably the second ode. It was composed in the spring, and the theme holds that the pleasant numbness of the speaker's indolence is a preferable state. It's almost like, you know, that feeling of indifference when you've resolved some tragedy or some difficulty or tension in your life. It's not that sense of victory or winning or losing or anything like that. It's indifference. the idea or the thought, the person comes, they go, so what? That, freeing, it's very liberating to experience that. They toil not, neither do they spin. One morn before me were three figures seen with bowed necks and joined hands, side-faced, and one behind the other stepped serene in placid sandals and in white robes graced. They passed like figures on a marble urn. When shifted round to see the other side, they came again, and when the urn once more shifted round and first seen shades return, and they were strange to me, as may betide with vases, in one deep infidian lore. How is this, shadows, that I knew ye not? How came ye muffled in so harsh a mask? Was it a silent, deep disguised plot to steal away and leave without a task my idle days? Ripe over the drowsy hour, the blissful cloud of summer indolence benumbed my eyes. My pulse grew less and less, pain had no sting, and pleasure's wreath no flower. Oh, why did ye not melt and leave my senses undaunted quite of all but nothingness? A third time passed they by, and passing, turned each one the face of moment whilst to me. My face and fall, my burn and aching, because I knew three. The first was a fair maid, the love her name. The second was ambition, pale of cheek, and ever watchful with fatigued eye. The last, who I love more, the more of blame is heaped upon her, maiden, most unmeek. I knew her to be my demon posy. They faded, and forsooth I wanted wings. Oh, folly, what is love, and where is it? And for that poor ambition, it springs from a man's little heart's short fever fit. Posy. No, she's not a joy, at least for me. So sweet as drowsy noons and evenings steeped in honey indolence. Oh, for an age so sheltered from annoy that I may never know how change the moons, or hear the voice of common sense. So, ye three ghosts, adieu. You cannot raise my head cool bedded in the flowery grass, for I would not be dieted with praise, a pet lamb in a sentimental farce. Fade softly from my eyes and be once more in mask like figures on the dreamy urn. Farewell. I yet have visions for the night, and for the faint day visions there is store. Vanish, ye phantoms. For my idol sprite into the clouds and nevermore return. Thank you. Sonny Rollins, a personal favorite. History. The things that happened that once were troubling, but with time have lost that that fervor, so that we leaving behind something that we can examine. Here we're talking about Le Candeur Lodge. And remember, the aristocrats were being critical and outspoken about it. And here we have it being articulated in their notes. I kind of think that I do think this is the way minutes became useful to us, not the standard checkbox type of thing that I often see or experience around me. Here, it picks up where we left off. It is the earlier, less censored class discourse of the aristocratic brothers of Le Candeur that commands our attention. Within this temple, we can find some of the few Masonic orations where the philosophies of the Enlightenment were actually attacked. In this instance, for persecuting religion, for, quote, preferring their reputation to the good order of their country and of God himself. And in Le Candeur, commonplace Masonic talk about the dangers of egoism could also be turned against the Enlightenment. Quote, egoism became so general in this century, aggravating even and spreading its poison until the unions of the most sacred blood are dissolved, making all too often the closest relatives into irreconcilable enemies. Ego. Similarly, in Le Candeur, brothers use traditional religious language to refer to the being of beings, the God of gods, rather than the grand architect, Yet clearly the two are meant to be interchangeable. In this aristocratic lodge, the religiosity being expressed by laymen is closer to that of the 17th century than it is to the commonplace theism, even deism, of the late 18th century. Indeed, the search for intimate union with God in the mind of the brothers chosen to speak before Le Candeur distinguished the Freemason from Le Vulgaire. In distinctively Catholic terms, they talked about submission to the will of God and repentance, of listening to the inner voice that makes known his will. Yet there is also a distinctive social message in the religiosity expressed within Le Candeur. Hereditary nobility had always sought to justify its existence by identifying nobility with virtue. In the rhetoric of the aristocratic Masons of Strasbourg, a man's inner virtue is what distinguishes him, not his sashes or jewels, not even his Masonic degrees. Nothing is more beautiful in nature than a soul full of candor, who senses his own integrity. The true Freemason judges not by appearances, by the exterior. He knows that man is governed by an intelligent spirit, and that the valor of his actions does not depend upon what is perceived. He places all his attention on the intention. The message here was double-edged. On the one hand, it contained a subtle rejection of opulence, and on the other, it said to look beyond the luxury, which is just there, into the heart of a man. Such sentiments could have an egalitarian impact. They could also be used to elevate and exclude. It is this elevation, this grandeur of spirit, that makes the true Mason preferable to all men. With his feet, he touches the earth. With his head, is in heaven. Intimately persuaded by this high calling, he keeps always before his eyes the more grand examples and works without pause for his perfection and to advance the happiness of men like myself. In this instance, Masonic religiosity is being used to redefine exclusivity, without, for an instance, challenging its inherent right to exist and its usefulness. The brothers of Le Candeur believed themselves to be reformers who refused to recognize other lodges that, quote, confer all the grades for the price of money, while we have suppressed this mercenary custom. Buying degrees and offices was something only moneyed men had to do initially. These aristocratic reformers could also describe themselves as simple workers. And their officers signed the minutes with a perfunctory bow toward the Enlightenment, that is, executed by par le lumière officier de la horloge. Ah. What do you think? They were taking the integrity of the lodge to that next natural level that tests our and reexamines our sense of compliance. Their thoughts, their arguments, their positions didn't always fit. There's a little Coleman Hawkins. Thank you. see that we've concluded the program, the show for today. Thank you for being part of it. I hope that it's been educational and informative and entertaining all at the same time. And I look forward to joining you next week when we continue on the never-ending conversation, the Masonic conversation. And wherever you are around the world, I wish you great safety and fraternity. Keep, as the history, just history portion just reminded us, keep our values in mind and keep them in front of us, particularly in times when we're being tested. It matters. It seems that it's the only time that I think Masonry and Masonic values show their depth is when things are not going well, when we recognize the truth of the world around us and we prevail. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness, my brethren, and include yourself. Be generous. I'll see you again soon. Thank you.